During World War II, American generals were quickly relieved of their commands when they failed to succeed. Interestingly, this system of firing ineffectual leaders has all but completely disappeared from our current military. And, says Thomas E. Ricks, that's created a culture of mediocrity. Mr. Ricks' latest book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today, explains the history of this change and the effect the widening gulf between performance and accountability is having on our military leadership. It's published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Thomas Ricks back to our show. Hello.
Hi, it's great to be back.
How are things in Washington?
A whole lot better than New York, I'll tell you. It's basically pretty normal here now.
And the subways were not affected?
No, it doesn't seem to be. I actually took one yesterday to come back across town, and it was pleasant.
Your previous book, Fiasco, which was a New York Times number one bestseller, took a close look at the American military's actions in Iraq. Were the problems you reported on there what got you thinking about writing this book?
Absolutely. I can actually tell you kind of unusually exactly where I got the idea for this book. I was in central Sicily, standing on a hilltop, when I was joining a staff ride, that is a military study of a battlefield or a campaign. And I was with a group of graduate students from Johns Hopkins University studying the American and British campaign and Canadian campaign in Sicily in the summer of 1943, which a lot of people know from the movie Patton. And the graduate student discussing the culminating battle of Sicily, at the highest town on the island, Troina, mentioned that at the end of the battle, General Terry Allen, commander of the division fighting there, was fired. And that stunned me because Allen was one of our most successful combat commanders in the first year of the war in both Africa and Sicily, commanded the 1st Infantry Division, the famous Big Red One. And I began wondering, I just come out of Iraq where no generals got fired, even for incompetence of extreme sorts. And I was wondering, how could we go from a situation where in World War II, a successful division commander was fired to a situation in Iraq where no one gets fired?
Well, why was he relieved of his command?
Well, it was odd. I mean, basically, Omar Bradley didn't like him. Terry Allen was a real hell-bent for leather, old-school army officer, comes out of the frontier. He fought banditos on the Mexican border. He was shot through the jaw in World War One. A machine gun bullet left a hole in his cheek that whistled whenever he got mad later in his life. He was a hard drinker, so hard drinking that on one occasion it was noted that he had to crawl to his Jeep. Omar Bradley, Dwight Eisenhower, the new men of the Army, the new sort of professionals rising up in World War II, didn't like him. The interesting problem was that George Marshall, who is really my hero in the book, Marshall is the overall commander of the U.S. Army in World War II, which includes the Air Force. Marshall really likes Terry Allen because he's a fighter. And so he goes and finds another division for Terry Allen, gives it to him, and Terry Allen takes it back to Europe. So what you have is a situation in World War II in which generally success was rewarded, failure was punished, those who adapted got promoted.
Could you have taken this back even further to the Civil War or World War One?
Well, you could. There's a real tradition in the U.S. military of relieving failure, rewarding success, and promoting the young guy who succeeds. You saw that in the Revolution. You saw it in the Civil War, especially with Lincoln removing a bunch of generals. You saw it in World War One with Pershing. The reason I began with Marshall, though, is Marshall is the father of the American superpower military. When he takes over the Army on September 1, 1939, really a momentous day in European history, when he takes over the Army, it's about 180,000 people, including the baby Air Force. When he steps down in 1945, it's a mechanized air and ground force of 9 million people. What an extraordinary transformation he oversees. And so that's really why I began the book with Marshall.
Well, we generally think of him because of his diplomatic role, the Marshall Plan. Should he be given more credit as a military thinker?
Absolutely. It was Marshall's approach that really shaped how we fought World War II. It was not inevitable that he would become chief of the Army. Interestingly, he was picked by Franklin Roosevelt, to oversee the Army because he was so candid and straightforward with Roosevelt. And Roosevelt liked that. twice in the Oval Office, Marshall crossed Roosevelt and said, no, I disagree. He actually kept his distance from Roosevelt also. He when Roosevelt called him George, Marshall made it clear he preferred to be called General Marshall. He didn't hang out with the president like today's generals do. He didn't like Tommy Franks going to George Bush's ranch. He actually declined invitations to go visit Roosevelt at Hyde Park, Roosevelt's home. And the first time he ever went there was for Roosevelt's funeral, where he was a pallbearer. He wouldn't even laugh at Roosevelt's jokes. But he was very candid, straightforward with Roosevelt. He told him when he disagreed, and if he lost the argument, he'd go out and execute his orders. He also picked people carefully. One way he shaped the war was the generals he picked. He plucked Eisenhower, who at the beginning of 1940 was a lieutenant colonel who was the number two officer in an infantry regiment, the executive officer. And he promotes him very quickly. And one of my favorite
over General Patton.
Patton was an older guy. Patton, in many ways, would have been more, if you were going by a seniority system, who's next in line, which is kind of how today's Army operates, Patton would have been a much more natural pick to be the Supreme Allied Commander rather than this young Eisenhower guy. What a disaster he would have been, stepping on British and Russian toes, going around slapping soldiers. Eisenhower was picked specifically because Marshall thought, when we go into our next war, when we go into World War II, we will be unprepared because we tend to go into war unprepared. So we're going to fight some tough battles at the beginning. We're going to lose a little bit. So I need an optimistic guy. Second, we're going to have to fight alongside allies. So I need a cooperative guy. Third, this is going to require enormous energy. So I want a young, determined, ambitious guy. And he looked around the Army and he said, this young Dwight Eisenhower, he's the guy.
Now,
and he promotes him very quickly and then pulls him into Washington a week after Pearl Harbor Day, after Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941.
What's the role of a general? Has it changed? When Marshall is looking, is he thinking about somebody who's taking a hands-on role or somebody who can focus on broad strategies and has skills in dealing with the people who are working for him?
The role of a general is to examine the nature of the conflict in front of him, to understand it, and to figure out what works. That is not the way I think a lot of today's generals think about it. Exhibit A would be Tommy Franks, who I don't think understood the wars he fought in Iraq or Afghanistan.
You call him a two-time loser.
Yeah, I think he screwed up two wars. Franks somehow had the concept that if you take the enemy capital, you've won the war, like it was a big chess game. So he goes to Kabul in Afghanistan, he goes to Baghdad in Iraq, and then as one officer I know says, he spiked the ball on the 30-yard line and went home, not understanding that the war had just begun, that it was hardly over. So a general needs to understand the war. The exception to today's generals would be David Petraeus, who goes to Iraq and says, you know, we need to operate differently here. We need to ask them tough questions. We can't keep on patting ourselves on the back and saying we're the best army in the world, so we must be winning. He actually takes some real risk, which is the other thing you don't see in a lot of today's generals, willingness to take risk that actually might get him in trouble.
Now, when did this begin? To some degree, I get the sense that you say Eisenhower actually set this ball rolling.
Well, Eisenhower and Bradley, the new men of World War II, were a little bit suspicious of the old school guys. But Marshall really had left his imprint on the Army. One of his leading protégés was Matthew Ridgway, who in the Korean War is given command late in 1950. And that's really when things began to change. Ridgway went in like a Marshall-trained general and began cleaning house. He wanted to fire five of the six division commanders in Korea and most of the regimental commanders. And the Army started getting very antsy, and I've actually gone and found the documents where the Army sends them notes from the Pentagon saying, you know, you can get rid of these guys, but you kind of got to disguise it. Find a place to park these guys. And the reason the Army gives him is Congress is going to start asking embarrassing questions. And I think that's why you start losing this tradition of relieving failures, is when you're fighting a small war like Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, unpopular wars, firing people starts raising questions, and it becomes more difficult.
Where does MacArthur fit into all of this? He was fired by
Korea. MacArthur, he's just a piece of work. MacArthur is really just an anomaly out there. I don't understand how the American system quite produced MacArthur. I mean, here's a general who was insubordinate, not to one, not to two, but to three presidents, Hoover, Franklin Roosevelt, and Truman. And it's only Truman who decides to fire him. I think Roosevelt was a more Machiavellian figure. He thought that keeping MacArthur inside the tent in World War II was the perfect answer. Sort of this right-wing isolationist general, having him inside your army kind of keeps the right-wing isolationist of the Midwest inside the tent also during the war. Truman was a less Machiavellian figure than Roosevelt, a more straightforward guy, and he simply says, look, you can't talk to the president that way, you're fired. MacArthur, though, I'm amazed that they let him stay in power in the Korean War. He was old, he was kind of doddering, and he slapped aside the Joint Chiefs because they were the younger generals of World War II. He saw them as kids. Omar Bradley was a junior officer to him, even though Bradley, by Korean War, was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Had MacArthur not been fired by Truman, I think there's a good chance we would have wound up in a nuclear war with China. He was advocating the use of 35 or so nuclear weapons against China, bombing China's airfields, blockading its ports, and getting about 500,000 troops, nationalist Chinese troops out of Taiwan to come fight in Korea.
But when Terry Allen was fired, nobody said anything. When MacArthur was fired, it became a major news story, caused a political firestorm, because politics had entered this whole business of how our military was run. Was that something that developed as part of the Cold War?
No, MacArthur was always a real outlier as a political general. Eisenhower once commented that most generals, like Marshall, saw that you should keep out of politics. He said MacArthur never saw this line, and if he did, he was always on the other side of the line. MacArthur goes back, during the Bonus March, he presides over the routing of World War I vets in Washington, D.C., just a few blocks from where I'm speaking here. So he'd always been kind of political, kind of controversial. He really thought, according to subordinates, that he was going to be elected president in 1944. And again, in 1952, he kind of made a run for it. So I think what happened was MacArthur looked good from a distance. The little-known fact about him, he did not come to the United States from before World War II to until he was fired during the Korean War. This is like from 1938 or so to 1951. Even when President Truman asked him to come back, he said he was too busy. When the American people saw MacArthur close up, he seemed very different. He looked like a big blowhard during the senatorial hearings on his relief. And about 6 months later, I think he was appearing either at Ebbets Field or Yankee Stadium, and some guy yells out, "Hey, Mac, Truman's in the White House, and you're in left field." And he kind of became a laughing stock, I think, shortly after that.
My guest is Thomas E. Ricks. His latest book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. It is published by Penguin Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Thomas E. Ricks. His latest book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today, published by the Penguin Press. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, all commanding officers in Hawaii were fired, you point out. Yet after 9/11, no one was fired and no one took responsibility for intelligence failures. How did we get from a system where failure almost assured being relieved of a command to where it's practically non-existent? And I'm wondering if practically is the right word. Is it totally non-existent?
It's not totally non-existent. You do get some generals fired. But the generals who get fired by other generals are generally guys who couldn't keep their zippers closed. They embarrass the institution with sexual scandal or maybe some expense account mess. The generals we do see get fired at the very top are fired by civilians. So you get Westmoreland fired in Vietnam.
But after 4 years.
Yeah, it takes a while. And it's a lousy way to run an operation. It's like firing the manager of your baseball team every time you start losing a game. You don't want to fire the top guy always. Sometimes you just need a relief pitcher. And we have lost that tradition of firing division commanders and other generals for combat ineffectiveness. A little trivia, the last general I could find actually fired for not being an effective combat leader was an obscure guy named James Baldwin, fired as commander of the AmeriCal division in Vietnam in 1971. So, yeah, you're right. These days, being a general is like being a university professor. You've got tenure. You can be lousy at your job. The only way you're actually going to get fired is if you embarrass the institution publicly somehow.
General Westmoreland was in Vietnam from 64 to 68, and he continued to issue optimistic reports about the war effort. But despite what we were hearing from our journalists, why do we see any improvement when he was replaced by General Creighton Abrams?
Oh, quite a lot. Abrams really took a different approach to the war. This has become almost legendary inside the U.S. Army, how much the war improved under Creighton Abrams from 1968 to 71 or so. The problem was, by the time Abrams got there, by the time we started becoming operating differently and better, we really didn't have an army anymore. Decisions made by President Johnson and by Westmoreland really ruined the army very quickly. They didn't activate the reserves. They chewed up their sergeants, the NCO Corps, very quickly. And by 68, 69, when there really were opportunities in the field, when the Viet Cong had really been decimated, when the North Vietnamese Army was having a hard time, when there were actually Viet Cong starving for lack of rice, by that point we really didn't have an army really capable of doing much. You would find infantry companies of about 150 guys in combat in the field who only had three people who had been in the army more than 2 years. That's a very green, inexperienced force. Very different, by the way, from today's army, which is very at the enlisted level, at the sergeant level, in the soldiers, is very, very good tactically, well trained, well equipped, in good cohesive units. The problem is, they're not particularly well led at the top.
You say that in the 1950s, the Army became more corporate along with the rest of American society. How did the shift in society affect the top leadership of the military? Company men instead of mavericks?
The Army had two big problems. Yeah, they get rid of the mavericks in the 1950s. They're much more organization men. The other problem for the Army in the 1950s is the advent of the nuclear era. What is the role of a ground force with nuclear weapons on the battlefield? It was very unclear. Did we even need an army anymore? So by the mid-1950s, the United States is spending twice as much on the Air Force as it is on the Army. The Army feels very neglected. And this is where Maxwell Taylor comes in. In many ways, he's one of the major villains of my book. Really a disaster, I think, even more than MacArthur. Maxwell Taylor's chief of staff of the Army, trying to face this problem, what's our role in a world of nuclear warfare? He decides, hey, there's brush fire wars. Let's go start fighting small wars. And he looks around, and there's this place called Vietnam that looks real good. And this is one of the lessons here is you should research your market before you go and open a new business. And the Army opened its business in Vietnam, and it was not what it thought it was getting into. Westmoreland and the people around him assumed that, hey, we could beat the Nazis and the Japanese. Certainly we can beat a little peasant army in a corner of Southeast Asia. They assumed that the North Vietnamese would have a breaking point before we did. And this is why one of the themes of the book is you really need your civilian leaders and your military leaders to examine their assumptions before they go to war.
Well, aren't generals expected to play a political role, doing what Washington expects them to do? Has the line blurred between the White House and the Pentagon, as we saw with Donald Rumsfeld assuming the role of a general at times?
Yeah, Maxwell Taylor actually was one of the people who really blurred the lines, the sharp, bright lines that George Marshall had drawn in World War II. Maxwell Taylor becomes a politicized general, and this is actually, to me, one of the lessons of the Vietnam War. Maxwell Taylor makes his base of power at the White House. He actually becomes military advisor to John F. Kennedy, a post that had not existed before or since, and kind of raised the question of then what's the role of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs if there's a general sitting in the White House meeting with the president three times a day.
We have now a system of rotating officers every 6 months. How has that affected our operations in Iraq and Afghanistan?
In Vietnam, we rotated them every 6 months. In Iraq and in Afghanistan, yeah, we've rotated them with whole units every year. I think it's really had a bad effect. We've had 11 commanders, overall commanders, in Afghanistan in 11 years. That just strikes me as nuts. Imagine rotating Eisenhower home in 1943, just after he learned how to fight the war, and they send out some other general to run the war. Rotating your commanders reminds me of something that Warren Buffett once said. If you've been playing poker for half an hour and you don't know who the patsy at the table is, you're the patsy. When you rotate your commanders, you have a guy who's only been there a short time. So, say, President Karzai in Afghanistan, the Taliban opposition, they've all been around for years. They're there for the duration, like we were in World War II. We're treating this war with a casual arrogance. We can come in without knowing the place, fight the war, and go home after a year. That's just not a serious way to wage war.
I'm talking with Thomas E. Ricks. His latest book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today, published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In a little while, we will be bringing you Mayor Michael Bloomberg's press conference live when it happens, and we'll have to break to that as soon as he winds up on the podium. But I'm hoping to get in a lot more here because it's such a fascinating book. How did generals like Colin Powell and Norman Schwarzkopf embody all of the qualities and limitations that you've been discussing?
Norman Schwarzkopf was the classic post-Vietnam Army general, tactically very competent. The U.S. Army came out of Vietnam and said, we've got to really get better at fighting, and which is a good first step. And they focus, we're going to win the first battle. And they produce a generation of generals entirely focused on winning the first battle, but who are taught nothing about how to win a war, how to terminate a war. And so you got Schwarzkopf, who is a classic example of the 91 Gulf War. He goes and he fights a terrific fight, a great battle. They win, and he has not a clue what to do next. Nor has Colin Powell or the White House really thought about it. Powell then was chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And so we botched the end of the 91 war. And instead of it being a great victory, in retrospect, it looks like the beginning of a 20-year war with Iraq.
Now, you mentioned that you thought Tommy Franks was a two-time loser. His successor was General Ricardo Sanchez. Was he much better?
No, but I'm more sympathetic to him because Sanchez was a young junior general, the youngest lieutenant general, or the newest lieutenant general in the U.S. Army, who was just kind of chucked into Iraq because he was the next guy in line. There was this inattention, this casual arrogance I'm talking about, where, oh, Sanchez is the next guy in line, give him the war, without a consideration of what type of war is it, who would adapt to it. The thinking that Marshall did about Eisenhower in World War II simply was not done.
Now, during his command, the Abu Ghraib scandal happened.
Yeah,
what was his reaction? Was he punished for it?
No, he wasn't really. He leaves the Army very bitter because he wanted a four-star. He was a lieutenant general, a three-star general. He expected to be promoted to four stars. Here, Iraq blows up on his watch, and he has this sense of entitlement, which is, hey, I did my year in Iraq, now give me a promotion.
And then he is followed by General Casey. You say he was barely treading water.
Well, Casey knew there was a problem, knew he needed to address it differently. A very conventional man who recognizes that his very conventional army needs to start operating unconventionally. So he takes some first steps towards it, but he really is not able to alter the way the army's fighting in Iraq at that point. In 2006, on his watch, Iraq became a disaster. It really was a very close-run thing in 06 about, you know, Baghdad just falling apart utterly in a civil war.
After she left the military, Brigadier General Janice Karpinski was a guest on our show. She was the commander of prisons at Abu Ghraib. She claimed that she was scapegoated for what happened, that others were more responsible. Was she punished?
Not really, because there was some murky stuff in her background. Was she demoted because of Abu Ghraib or because it turned out there was a shoplifting charge against her? So, but she certainly was scapegoated because she was this, you know, the real outlier, a female one-star reservist military police officer. It was easy to blame her. The blame actually should have gone far higher. Yes, to Sanchez and perhaps even to General Abizaid, the people above her. Certainly, General Sanchez set her up for failure. They stuffed Abu Ghraib with tens of thousands of detainees, many of them innocent farmers just swept up, many of them genuine terrorists. They didn't actually set up a way for processing them. They actually fouled up their intelligence system, so al-Qaeda people sometimes weren't not interviewed for 90 days. In interrogation, the gold standard is you need to interview people within 24 hours and ideally within 2 to 3 hours.
Tom, we have to take a little break here. Can you sit there? We'll be right back.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm talking with Thomas E. Ricks. His latest book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today, published by the Penguin Press. We are back with Thomas E. Ricks, his latest book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today, published by the Penguin Press. If General Marshall were still in control, he would have fired some of these people, but were there others who might have done a better job?
A better job in Iraq or Afghanistan?
Yeah. Is the culture of the military such that anybody who had been moved up would have been just as inadequate, as you see it, as the ones who wound up in the jobs?
Well, General Petraeus is an obvious exception to this. And if you look at his background, he's an outlier himself among Army generals. He has a PhD from Princeton, which makes him kind of an intellectual. He likes talking to reporters. He even enjoys the political atmosphere of Washington. Now, in today's Army, that's three strikes. And what's more, he was successful in his first tour in Iraq, commanded the 101st Airborne, which means he made everybody else look bad. But you do have, aside from a few outliers like General Petraeus, there was General Jim Dubik, a few others, you had a very conventional, kind of anti-intellectual set of generals who were not adaptive, who were not able to think critically. They were generals who were trained rather than educated. The distinction here is that training prepares you for the known. Education prepares you for the unknown, for the ambiguous, difficult situation. Education enables you to think critically about the situation in front of you and to come up with new solutions. And that, for example, is what General Petraeus did in Iraq. He cut a deal with the Sunni insurgents in which he put 100,000 of them on the American payroll. I've always been amazed that this wasn't a more controversial thing. I asked him once, when you sought approval from President Bush to put the Sunni enemy on the American payroll, what did he say? He said, I did not ask for his approval. It was within my existing authorities. Well, that's a pretty ballsy assessment. That's real risk-taking, and that's something you don't see in a lot of today's generals. Not only are they kind of conventional and unable to think critically, they also are risk-averse. They are content to go into their one-year rotation, don't stick your head up, don't take risk, and go home after 1 year. That's not a recipe for winning a war. It's a recipe for mediocrity and stalemate, which may explain our situations in Afghanistan and Iraq a little bit.
But you also said that part of their success, the good ones, is their ability to deal with the unknown. Since the nature of war changed after World War II, weren't they trying to figure it out as they went along?
Well, during the Cold War, you really didn't need a lot of strategic thinking. In Vietnam, it would have helped. But generally,
well, they were fighting guerrillas instead of exactly. It was not trench warfare anymore.
But for most of the Cold War, we had almost the perfect enemy, the Soviet Union. Big, slow, dumb, conservative, kind of the brontosaurus of opposition. It was very easy not to have to think strategically. We knew what the enemy was. We knew he would adapt slowly. We weren't really under a lot of pressure. The Cold War ends, and suddenly you're in a very fast-moving, complex, ambiguous world where it's not even clear what the enemy is or what success is. And you have a bunch of generals who are entirely unprepared for that. They're well-trained tactically. They lead a tactically magnificent force, a very proficient combat-effective force. But they really have not a clue about how to lead it through battles into winning wars, which is really what a general is supposed to do.
Now, we talked earlier about General Tommy Franks, who you say had the rare distinction among American generals of bungling two wars in 3 years and actually allowing Osama bin Laden to escape in Tora Bora. What happened to him after he came back from those two wars? Was he kicked up the chain of command?
No. As someone in the military said to me, he put down his rucksack early. He retired and did the American equivalent of a Roman triumph. He wrote his memoirs and started giving speeches for high fees. And now lives on a ranch in Texas where I am told he keeps two bulls named Shock and Awe.
Fascinating book. Where do you go from here?
I'm not sure. I'm thinking of writing a book about the Vietnam War. It amazes me that the war's been over for about four decades, and there's still not, almost five decades, there is still not a good operational history of the Vietnam War. I mean, there's a couple of books written in the 80s, but there's a lot of information out there that's never been collected. I'm not sure, though, I want to spend the next 5 years of my life thinking about Vietnam, so I've got to make a decision about that.
Well, do you think that the military culture can be changed? I'm sure people at the Pentagon are reading this book and saying, boy, does he not understand the way it really works.
It's funny, I actually just got an invitation about half an hour ago to come over and speak to the staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff next week. And my editor sent me a note asking if I needed a bodyguard. But really, I don't. I need a bodyguard. I wrote back to him, no, they're just inviting me to come over and say the things that they think, but they can't say aloud about the generals.
So this is something that the military has been aware of and yet has been unwilling to change?
Yes. The funny thing is the younger officers are very aware of it and write about it a lot on my blog, Best Defense on foreignpolicy.com. But the generals really are like a guild these days, looking out for their own. The saying in the military when there's punishment for generals is different spanks for different ranks. Generals don't get punished. Sergeants do. But it is, to answer your question, it is very easy to change. You can summarize it in one word, accountability. I actually have an article in Harvard Business Review, October edition, about accountability and its importance. If you look for accountability, if you enforce it, if you reward success and punish failure, that changes the institution very quickly. Last night, a general asked me, how can we make our officers more adaptive? And I said, reward the successful, and don't reward the unsuccessful. You'll get them. This is what Marshall did in World War II. The reason we know names like Eisenhower, Gavin, Ridgway, is he had a Darwinian system. Either you were dead or relieved or successful in 90 days. And if you were successful, you got promoted. So these younger generals rose very quickly. That doesn't happen nowadays. And I think if you did reward the young, successful officer and moved aside the guy who isn't successful, you very quickly would change the culture of the military.
Now, earlier I asked you something, and then we got sidetracked. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, all the commanding officers in Hawaii were fired. After 9/11, no one was fired, and no one took responsibility for intelligence failures. Was that the responsibility of the military, or wasn't it more the responsibility of the CIA and the NSA?
It was partially the responsibility of the military, but no. Most of it was NSA, CIA, National Security Council, and so on. But there, if you go back and look at the 9/11 Commission's report, they actually found that the Air Force was not honest with them. And as far as I'm aware, there was no fallout from that either.
Tom, thank you so much. Thomas E. Ricks, whose previous book was Fiasco. This one is already causing a stir. It's called The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today, published by the Penguin Press.